Welcome to Valley Talk. I'm your host, Heather Stark, and I have a guest with me today. And that guest you may have heard of, I'm not sure, but you might recognize the name, Tim Eyman. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
You're welcome. And, you know, one of the things that I've learned about you is people either love you or they hate you.
It tends to run hot and cold.
Yeah,
yes, it does.
I found no neutral parties when I mentioned Tim Eyman. Nobody's neutral. How does that make you feel?
Oh, it's all good. It's all good. I mean, the role of an initiative activist, especially a political activist, I mean, your goal isn't to be well-liked or well-respected, and I think I've successfully accomplished those two goals over the last 20 years.
Many of us have accomplished that goal, just not as visibly. Okay?
That's true. But, you know, the goal of an initiative activist is to, you know, challenge your elected officials to do better than they're currently doing and try and identify areas where you're trying to poke them and prod them in the right direction. And I think in the state of Washington, the area of taxation, they're really awful. And so being an initiative activist is about letting people have a chance to vote to make things a little bit better.
So is that how you define yourself, as an initiative activist?
It's probably narrower because we do go down to Olympia a lot. And
is that the royal we?
The royal we, exactly. No, I mean, we've got a really big email list and mailing list of supporters that email legislators. And when we hear about bills that are happening down in Olympia, we encourage people to go and testify against them, email against it. So it is kind of narrow to talk about initiative activists. But obviously, that's where we get most of our leverage with our elected officials, is that normally they don't listen to you if you're just one person. But if you have 352,000 people that signed a petition, you know, they're kind of forced to listen.
Okay. I want to back up a little bit, because when you were a little kid, did you say, I don't want to be a firefighter, I don't want to be a doctor, lawyer, candlestick maker, I want to be an initiative activist? How did this come about?
That's a good question. I mean, I was born and raised Yakima, and then went to Wazoo, where I got a business degree. I was never politically active or anything like that. And then I moved over to the west side, you know, our side of the state, and had a kind of a small company, small business that I started, a mail order company that was selling these, you know, fraternity and sorority watches through the mail. And I just kind of started paying attention to politics a little bit. And then I was thinking, it's my early 30s, and I was, God, what was it? It was the mid-90s, and they had the vote on the sports stadium. And for those that are not familiar with this issue, is that we used to have a kingdom in the state of Washington.
Aren't we still paying for that?
And we are still paying for that. And they wanted to bring that down and build a new stadium. And there was this local initiative in Seattle that asked, do the voters think this is a good idea? And I wasn't a leader of the initiative or anything. I just heard about it. I thought it was kind of interesting. And so I went to one of their meetings. I picked up a handful of petitions. And one afternoon, I went to Green Lake in Seattle and spent 3 hours collecting signatures. I think I got like 100 or something, and talking with people and interacting with them. And I had this cardboard sign, and it was just handwritten on it. It said, public vote on sports stadium. And that sign just drew a lot of attention, and people would come up and ask about it. And I just said, if you sign this, all you're doing is putting it on the ballot and let the voters decide on whether or not we want this huge, monstrous sports stadium. So that was kind of my first baptism of fire, if you will, on the initiative process.
Okay. And so you loved it so much, you decided that you had to do more?
Well, it was interesting, as the initiative ended up qualifying for the ballot, which I've subsequently learned is no sure thing. And so it did qualify. And then the voters ended up voting. And the voters of Seattle said, we don't want to do this. We're voting no. And I thought, wow, this system works. This is kind of exciting. And then about 2 months later, the legislature called an emergency session of the legislature, and they said it was a threat to the public health and safety for us to, you know, not build a stadium. And so we have to build the stadium. And they overruled what the voters had just said that they wanted. And that was my baptism of fire with the initiative process. And I just remember thinking to myself, you dirty dogs. I don't get it. You're elected to represent us. We made a decision. Should be end of story. Instead, they basically overruled the voters and moved from being representatives to rulers. And that really, you know, stuck in my craw for a long time. But that was my first initiative experience that really kind of got me hooked.
about that experience, and I remember that. I worked at the Columbia Tower. Great fisheye view of the kingdom. And when the legislature enacted their legislation, that it was a crisis if we didn't do what they wanted.
An emergency.
Yes.
Not a crisis. It was an emergency.
I don't remember a lot of outrage over that. There was some, but not a lot. And I viewed that as, whether you disagreed with the whole initiative or not, the fact that the legislature just chose to completely bulldoze over that, that's what made me feel outraged.
Absolutely. And that, I remember thinking at the time, it didn't matter how the voters voted that I was upset about. I mean, I was fine if the voters had validated. I was fine with the voters making the decision. But to have the politicians overrule what the voters had done, and I remember that was like a low point in trust in government. I mean, that just bottomed things out.
People, you mean it's come up since then?
People have been spitting mad. And I was just literally being interviewed about 4 days ago, and a guy came by, and the radio person was interviewing him and me, and he said, it reminds me of the sports stadium, and he brought it up, and I was struck by that, you know, mid-90s, do some math, that was 25 years ago that happened, yet people still remember it, and I remembered thinking to myself, this is just so messed up and so awful, but I remember just thinking, but it was very empowering that the voters had a chance to vote at all, and so then I kind of moved on and decided to do another initiative on another topic.
So when did you decide to make it your career?
It was interesting. It was each one just kind of built on the other. It wasn't like some master plan, but it was I was reading the Wall Street Journal, and I heard about this businessman from California named Ward Connerly, and he's a black businessman who is a university regent in the UC Berkeley system, UC, you know, California college system, and he said government should treat everyone equally. And he led an initiative down in California to prohibit the government from treating it differently based on your race, your gender, in public employment, public education, public contracting. And it was called Prop 209. And I remembered being, wow, this is just amazing, the courage this guy had to do it. And he was on C-SPAN, and I remember he said something that just really struck with me. He said, white people need to have the courage to talk about it too. And what happens all the time when you talk about affirmative action is the people that are, people of color start talking about it, and people that are white kind of pull back and they go, whoa, I'm not getting into that snake pit. I'm not talking about that because I'm, no matter what I say, it's going to be wrong. And he said, you have to have the courage to do it. So I called him up and I said, hey, I just saw that you passed this Prop 209. I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to try and, you know, take a run at it here in Washington State. And I'm waiting for a pep talk. I'm waiting for the sales job. And he goes, all right, well, we'll see how you do. And he hung up. And I remember going, whoa, all right. You know, it's all on you, you know. So, we ended up working on it for a long period of time. And we can talk about it more. But that was my first time
actually.
I-200. That was the first one that I actually was a co-sponsor of. I wasn't a sole sponsor. I was co-sponsoring it with somebody else. And we worked on it for 9 months for a signature drive. Mm-hmm.
Well, in looking at this list of initiatives that you've been involved in, many of which have passed. As a matter of fact, there's a list going back to 1998, which is the first one, which is I-200, the one you just talked about. Mm-hmm. You've had 24 initiatives that you've waved before the public. You've run up the flagpole, and 10 of them have passed.
It's actually, I'll just throw out some numbers. It's turns out we've qualified 17 for the ballot during that entire period of time. These are the statewide ones. I think you're including some of the local ones.
Yep.
And those are great. And I love the local ones too. But, you know, most people, it's the statewide stuff. So we've qualified 17 for the ballot. The voters have approved 10 of them. You're exactly right. And, but to me, 17 of them were successes, because every initiative you qualify for the ballot is a victory, because you know that the voters are going to get a chance to vote on it. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the ultimate thing, is that you win the debate just by having one, mm-hmm. because you're trying to tackle a problem that your politicians won't fix. So in this case, it was affirmative action, whether it's car taps or property taxes or whatever. But the first one was interesting because I was such an abysmal failure at it. So my first experience being a sponsor, me and this other guy, we ended up working on it for like 6 months, and we're busting our butts, but we have no idea what we're doing. And we're trying to raise money, and we're trying to collect signatures, we're trying to organize people, and we just sucked. We were awful. And we eventually went to a leader in our state called named John Carlson, who had done quite a few initiatives in the 90s and had a lot of experience with it. And I just basically groveled. I just went, you know, God, John, this is such a great initiative. I think the voters would vote for it, but we just suck at this. You know, would you take it over? And he said, I'll think about it. And then I did the smartest thing I ever did, and that was I didn't let him just wait around and think about it. I called Ward Connerly from California, and it's like calling God. And Ward is this guy in our state, big leader. He's thinking about it, but if you call him, I think he respects you as much as I respect you. Would you be willing to call him? And he did. And seriously, Ward Connerly is just this overarching, deep, you know, voice guy. And he was such a leader in California on this. And so he called John, and they took the campaign over. And I remembered John said, so what role do you see yourself in with the initiative? And I said, you know, hey, I'm putting it up for adoption, you know, and you can't have mixing metaphors. You can't have too many chefs in the kitchen. So it's your baby now. So I don't want to be involved with it at all. You know, you lead it, you handle it, and you take the thing over. And he successfully ended up carrying it over the finish line. They got enough signatures. They ended up running the campaign to pass it. But I remembered thinking to myself, you know, wow, this is a success, because it, even though it was put up for adoption, essentially, it still ended up being successful. And so, you know, my first foray into sponsoring an initiative, I was an abysmal failure as the sponsor, but the idea itself did carry forward and has been the law for the last 20 years.
Oh, there's other initiatives that you've been active on kind of ring a bell. 1999, cut the state motor vehicle excise tax. I have this sense of
car
deja
taps.
Vu.
Yes.
I have this sense of deja vu.
We've been here before, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened to that? Because it was passed.
Yeah, it's really interesting. In 1998, after John took over the other initiative, I started looking around for kind of a new idea. And there was this governor from Virginia named Gilmore, and he ran for governor on a slogan called No Car Tax. And they have a really high car tax over in car tap tax in Virginia also. And I read about it in the Wall Street Journal, something about the Wall Street Journal. And I'm the great plagiarizer. I mean, I'm copying other people's ideas because I think, you know, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel. And he ran on it and ran for governor and won on it. And so I sponsored an initiative called the No Car Tax Initiative in 1998 and failed at that one as well. Because people would ask me, no car tax, so you mean like the sales tax? And I go, no, I'm talking about the motor vehicle excise tax. And they go, I don't know what that is. I said, it's that sticker on your plate. And they go, oh, your tabs? And so that kind of resonated with me. And they said, and no car tax, so we don't pay anything. I go, no, we're getting rid of this extra tax, but you still pay the filing fee. So I'm not going to pay, so there's all these questions that came up. So bottom line is I failed with that initiative. And it was only after that failure, two failures in a row, essentially, that we eventually did what was called Initiative 695, where we called it the $30 license tab initiative. And that one really, really took off like a rocket. But the thing I'm always trying to illustrate to people is that it's not like I just suddenly snapped my fingers and I suddenly got good at initiatives. I just made lots of mistakes along the way and was, there's a famous saying that Winston Churchill says is success is stumbling from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And that I find pretty apropos for this, because each one was a step toward learning what it takes to actually be successful at it. You just got to be willing to persevere and just keep coming back again and again. So that initiative qualified. Got 500,000 signatures. It was like the second highest number of signatures in state history. And the, you know, opponents just, you know, just bombarded it with, and this should start sounding familiar. They would run these really scary TV ads, and they would have all these threats and lies and scare tactics. And they just did everything they could to just get people all scared about voting for it. And I just kept saying, hey, it's up to the voters. It's your decision. But this is really a tax cut for the little guy. It's finally a chance for us to get something for ourselves, because the politicians always do it for them. Why don't we do something for us? And the initiative ended up passing, and that was kind of the first initiative I sponsored where I kind of took it, if you will, over the finish line where the voters had voted for it. So it's pretty gratifying. And I remember on election night, everybody's real excited, and it was just a really neat evening, and they were... You know, there's the media started making it about me, and I just kept trying to say, well, it was 514,000 people signed the petition. Voters.
Why do you
it.
Think they made it about you? I mean, are we talking personality here?
It's so much easier to write a news story about a person than it is a what they would view as a mob. Mm-hmm. Because they would say, well, how do you interview 514,000 people? You can't. We have to boil it down to one thing. And they would kind of focus in on me. And so even the opponents during that time, they said, it's the watch salesman. They were doing this a lot. They went, Tim Iman's just a watch salesman. He only went to Wazoo. He only got a business degree. He doesn't have a master's. He doesn't have a doctorate. We have super smart people on our coalition that's telling everybody that this is a stupid idea. And one of my favorite ones, the state treasurer said, Iman's as dumb as a brick. And that's an insult to the brick. It was awesome. He's very, very, very colorful. So it's pretty dramatic.
Well, there's been a lot of colorful stuff. I'm thinking of the, wait a minute, let me pull out my little paper here.
Oh, there's a laundry list.
There is Initiative 831.
Oh, that's a good one.
Do you remember that
yes,
one?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm gonna read that.
Please
for the
do.
Benefit
Knock
of our
yourself.
Listeners. I mean, clearly you've developed a thick skin.
Oh, dinosaur.
Initiative 831 actually was not a real initiative. However, as our Secretary of State, what year was this? This was in the 90s.
2003.
I, Sam Reed, Secretary of State of the State of Washington and custodian of its seal, hereby certify that according to the records on file in my office, the attached copy of the initiative measure number 831 to the people is a true and correct copy as it was received by this office. Initiative to the people. Whereas Tim Iman's ill-conceived anti-tax initiatives are an irresponsible means of legislating tax policy, an abuse of the initiative process, an insult to our system of representative democracy, and whereas Tim Iman is an admitted liar who paid himself $45,000 from campaign funds while publicly denying any personal gain from the statewide initiatives he sponsored, and whereas Tim Iman, it goes on and on and on for about half a page, whereas Tim Iman readily admits in his own words that I just feel like an ass. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the citizens of the state of Washington do hereby proclaim that Tim Iman is a horse's ass.
That's it. That's it.
Now, that has to be one of the most profound political commentaries from an elected official I have ever seen.
Well, and what's funny about it, I said, you know, God, when they print up the mugs and they print up the T-shirts, I've got in-laws and I've got family members that will buy them out. They will buy them out. So yeah. So one reporter said, I loved it to death because I didn't take offense at it at all. It's like, good luck getting 300,000 signatures, because that's what it's going to take to qualify that initiative for the ballot. Mm-hmm. And the initiative process is pretty ruthless. You know, you can have a nice idea, and for $5, you can put an idea out there. But in order to qualify, you have to get several hundred thousand people to sign a piece of paper that say, I think this is a good idea. Mm-hmm. And you have to do it in about 4 months. And that's really extraordinarily hard. It's nothing short of remarkable that over the last 20 years, we've gotten 17 of them qualified for the ballot, because one sucks the very marrow out of you as far as what it takes to really throw yourself into it. But for me, it's just, I think it's just really gratifying that the voters have had a chance to vote that many times for something that they're not going to get from their politicians.
Yeah. Well, I think I have interviewed some politicians and some elected officials and some employees who carry some clout at the county level. And one of the comments if he's listening, hey, you know who we are. He made a comment to me. We were not talking about Tim Iman, but we were talking about local control of taxes and, you know, levies, that kind of thing. And he made the comment that it was a stupid system to allow individual citizens to vote on things like that because they don't have the depth of knowledge and the big picture that the elected officials have.
I gag.
And I wanted to just kick him. And you know where I wanted to kick him. You know, I mean, what an arrogant attitude.
It's terrifically not unique, though. Arrogant.
Not to say that oftentimes elected officials don't have a much broader picture. However, this is our system of government. The citizen gets to have input. And I found that extremely arrogant. It sounds like you've had those feelings and those reactions as well. Is that part of the motivator? Keeps Tim Iman chugging away?
Well, I think that, and I always point this out in every debate that I'm with elected officials, is that you're used to being really important. You know, I debated the Everett mayor and State Senator Hobbs and Cassie Franklin, the Everett mayor. And I said, you guys are used to being very, very important and having tremendous power. When you're dealing with a citizen initiative, their vote counts exactly the same as anybody else that was in that audience. And I said, your vote, talking to the camera, counts the same as the governor's vote. Everybody's equal. Nobody has more power than anybody else. If you're the powerful, if you're the elite, if you're the big business groups that are used to buying off politicians, or you're the labor groups, or you're the environmental groups, or you're the media, and you're used to having tremendous power, you're suddenly now no different than anybody else. And it gets in their psyche. This, you can't let the unwashed masses make such an important decision. That's why we smart people make these decisions. And the thing that drives me crazy is they do. 99.9% of the time, representative democracy, our elected officials, make the decisions. This legislative session, they passed 500 bills into law. 500 from representative democracy. There's one initiative on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
One. So we get to vote on one, they got to vote on 500. And I challenge you to say that our elected officials know more about those 500 laws than the citizens know about one of our initiatives. Because an initiative has to go through multiple months of analysis, of debate, of discussion. In Olympia, they raised 11 different taxes on the last weekend just before the last day of the legislative session, and you had legislators saying, I've never even seen this bill, and I'm being asked to vote for it on the floor. And that happens all the time in Olympia. And
well, it happens all the time in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. In Washington, D.C., it's exactly the same. But initiatives go through a public policy rectal exam that is like nothing that ever happens down in the legislative process. And when they start saying, well, we're smarter and we've got better analysis, you're dealing with hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of issues. We're trying to deal with one. And I think the average voter has as good an understanding of the pros and cons of voting for example, $30 tabs this November as those legislators had on a bill that got dropped in their lap on the last day before they even had a chance to read it. They were forced to vote on it. Yeah. And they passed it because that was what the whole idea was. They wanted plausible deniability to say, well, yeah, I voted for it, but I didn't really know what was in it if it all blows up in their face.
Yeah. Well, on that note, we're going to have to take a little break. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about the latest initiative that we're going to be voting on.
Fun.
And we're going to be talking about, now look at 976?
976.
Yeah. Initiative 976. We're going to be talking about that. And it is, guess what? About car tabs.
Yeah.
We're going to be right back to talk with Tim Iman. I'm Heather Stark. And remember, if you have complaints about the show, email Tim Iman, not me. Okay? We'll be right back.
Join Valley 104.9 for our brand new 2-hour blues show starting October 2nd at 7 p.m. It's the Blues Highway with me, Mike Suttles, featuring old blues, new blues, all kinds of blues. Heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. right here on Valley 104.9, your home of Northwest Eclectic Music.
Hello, Duval, Washington, in the Snoqualmie Valley. Get the latest health and medical news each week on Mayo Clinic Radio, airing Sunday at noon on Valley 104.9, and catch the Mayo Clinic Health Minute at 8:20 a.m. and 5:20 p.m. each weekday.
Welcome back to Valley Talk. I'm your host, Heather Stark. With me is Tim Eyman. You either love him or you hate him. I've learned that over the last couple of weeks. I'm enjoying our conversation, though, Tim. I really, really am enjoying it. We've been talking a little bit about the history, what got you into becoming the initiative guru, which I guess you've been christened. You know, I keep talking to them here around Valley Radio about my needing a tiara. I really do need a crown, you know. Perhaps you could get one that says initiative guru that you could wear in your public appearances.
Well, it's always so funny in these news stories. They go guru, king, and I'm like, well, those are certainly a couple of the four-letter words that are used to describe me once in a while. But no, I mean, it is that they're just trying to encapsulate what it's all about. Mm-hmm. So
there really is a lot of hatred for you, though. It's not just you have a differing opinion. I mean, there just seems to be such vitriol. And I remember back in the 90s when you were first getting started, and mm-hmm. some of these initiatives were first getting started, there wasn't that level of vitriol. Is that just part of the political scene that we're seeing now? Or
no, it was back then too. Like I said, you know, it was the watch salesman, dumb as a brick, the insult mm-hmm. to the brick. What was it? Self-aggrandizing punk was mm-hmm. one. I was.
Well, are you?
It was just whatever they want to say. I was like herpes because I flare up every couple of years.
That's harsh. Yeah.
One after another. The political cartoons. There was one where I was Osama bin Laden. There was one where I was flying a plane into the Capitol because our initiative was going to destroy the Capitol like on 9/11. I mean, they jack it up in the theory that if we can just convince voters that Tim Eyman's a bad guy, then they'll stop voting for his initiatives. And I've always understood all along that they could run front page stories saying that I smoke crack cocaine and it would not matter one iota to the average voter, because the average voter doesn't give a flying rat's butt about Tim Eyman. They will say, what does the initiative do? And if they agree with it, they'll vote for it. If they don't agree with it, they'll vote against it. And the opponents seem to think that if they can shoot the messenger, that somehow the idea will die. And for 20 years, I've understood the role of an initiative sponsor is essentially to draw all the fire from the opponents in order to be able to draw more attention to the issue and let them punch themselves out, because at the end of the day, it's not going to really make any difference.
I-976, which we have the opportunity to vote on, is once again a car tab initiative, $30 car tab initiative. And boy, is it stirring the pot. One report, editorial from the San Juan County Ferry Advisory Committee said I-976 would have an immediate effect on funding for ferry operations as well as maintenance and improvements. Seattle Times said if 976 prevails, the state would lose $1.9 billion over 6 years toward highway and ferry maintenance, state troopers, and multimodal projects for transit, pedestrians, and bicyclists. And the Office of Financial Management estimates that 62 city and county governments might lose $350 million. That scares people because they think, wait a minute, I like riding the ferries. Wait a minute, I don't want to pay more for the ferry. Wait a minute. So why do you think that they are using this approach to try and convince people that, yeah, you might save a couple bucks on your car tabs, but look at what else it's going to cost you? And how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, 20 years ago, when we did our first $30 tabs initiative, they spent $2.2 million opposing it, and we spent nothing. We didn't have any money to be able to spend on TV ads or radio ads. I think I printed up a couple of campaign signs, and I got some T-shirts. But the reality was we were radically outspent. And what they did was they did a bunch of threats, lies, and scare tactics. And by the end, it was like children will be dying in the streets and flies will be flying around their faces. And they jacked it up to the point of the absurd. And once the initiative passed, they did exactly what we said they were going to do, and that was to use the $1 billion tax surplus to backfill the affected programs. In the short run, they would end up using the existing revenues more effectively. And I said the reason they're going to do that is because it's an election year next year, and they want to be reelected. And they're not going to just let all these programs just suddenly go away, because they, all the people that are currently being funded by these programs, have enormous power. You're already dealing with Boeing, Microsoft, Amazon. They're spending millions of dollars trying to convince voters to vote no on this. There's simply no reason why they're not going to turn around once the initiative passes and lobby the legislature to say, hey, you guys have a $3.5 billion tax surplus. This initiative affects about $400 million per year. $400 million is quite a bit less than $3.5 billion. Take a portion of the extra money that they're taxing us with all the record revenues, backfill the programs, and let's adjust to a system where we don't have this dishonest tax anymore. Instead, we use existing revenues more effectively. The reason why I'm so confident that they're going to do it this time, just like they did last time, is last time, 1 year later, there was a Policy Center analysis done. It was called Washington Policy Center, did an analysis 1 year later, and they said, they looked back and they said, you guys made 22 predictions of what will happen if this initiative passes. 100,000 cops lost, cuts in ferries. They went through every single list, and the name of the study was called 695, 1 year later, the sky didn't fall. And they couldn't find one of the allegations or predictions of what they said would happen actually happened. What ended up happening was the government adjusted to the fact that the voters didn't want this revenue source, but they weren't saying no to what it was funding. They were simply saying no to that particular tax. And all the special interest groups that funded the no campaign all ended up getting right in line to Olympia, in line, and said, hey, we used to get that dishonest money. We used to get that dishonest tax money, and we still want to get money. Give us some of that. They have so much power, so much influence, they were able to backfill those programs. They'll do the same thing this time. So 1 year later, the sky didn't fall. If the sky didn't fall when it's a $1 billion tax surplus, why would it fall if there's a $3.5 billion tax surplus?
Well, that's a good point. A lot of the complaints are coming from Sound Transit supporters that if this passes, Sound Transit is going to be in trouble and it will not progress at the rate at which people want it to progress. And you're smiling because, of course, it's already so delayed and so over budget. You're smiling, and I know why you're smiling.
No, it's not that. It's not that. It's the fact that Sound Transit lies all the time. And I want to be very
Remember, that's email Tim Iman, not Heather Stark.
And I want to be very specific about that. They lied to the legislature. They lied to the voters. They lied to the attorney general, and they lied to the Supreme Court. The lie to the legislature. They went to the legislature and said in 2015, please give us the authority for us to raise taxes $15 billion. So the legislature granted them the authority to ask for $15 billion. They turned around and asked the voters for $54 billion. Judy Cliburn, the Democrat who was in charge of the House Transportation Committee, said afterwards and was quoted as saying, all we kept hearing throughout the session was this $15 billion number. If we had heard $54 billion, it never would have gone anywhere. So clearly, they misled the legislature. Then they turned around and said to the voters, if you vote for ST3, your car tabs will go up about $80. Every news story said $80. $80 on a $10,000 car, $80. Everyone's getting the bill after the election, and people's car tabs went up $300, $500, $800, and everyone's going, what happened to this $80 thing I kept hearing about? So they lied to the voters. Then there's a lawsuit going on right now, and they said, well, we have to use this one valuation system because we have no choice. And the attorney general had to pull out of the lawsuit because they had lied to them about which valuation schedule they were going. So the AG had to pull out of the case. And then Sound Transit tried to defend themselves just with the Supreme Court, and they lied to them too. The point is that Sound Transit is right now saying all sorts of things about 976, and it's just so laughable. What they're pissed about is they're saying, we stole the money fair and square. Don't give the voters another chance to be able to vote on this thing, because now they know how expensive these car tabs are. And so they're just frantic. And they say it's unfair that our initiative is going back to the voters because the voters already decided this. Well, that's when voters were told what they were told was going to happen. Now that they see what's actually happening, I think it's totally appropriate that when a government lies to you to get a yes vote, it's totally appropriate to go back to the voters and say to them, now that you know the truth, now that you know how dishonest this tax is, how artificially inflated and inaccurate it is, do you think this is fair? And I think that that's what this initiative does, is it gives the voters a chance to vote again on whether or not they want this particular tax to stay around.
Well, we'll find out what happens. One of the things that I want to talk about is this has come, this whole initiative guru thing has come to you at a great deal of cost. There's been a couple of lawsuits from the state's state attorney generals. First one you settled, supposedly for using funds to pay yourself. The second one is still ongoing and has been for quite some time. And that also has created cost in your personal life. How are you still, you know, at what point do you just say, I'm done with this? At what
point?
Well,
you didn't name it. I mean, bankruptcy, filed for bankruptcy in November, announced divorce at the same time. I mean, it's really intense stuff. So the bankruptcy is no fun. Divorce is no fun. It's pretty awful stuff. But go back. So in the early years, the first initiative I did, you know, I-200, $695 on $30 tabs, I wasn't getting paid anything. And I was a volunteer and really enjoyed it, really got a lot out of it. And then in 2000, I wanted to keep doing it, but I knew I couldn't be able to do it and not be compensated for my work. And so all the campaign reports showed me and my company being paid for my work. So it was all in the campaign reports that I was receiving this money. But like an idiot, anytime a press person would ask me, are you getting paid for your political work? I would say no. And if I had just said yes, it wouldn't have been a scandal.
Why did you say no?
It was just a stupid, dumb thing because I thought that if you're doing it as a volunteer, you're viewed more purely. And if you're doing it and getting paid for it, you're viewed dirtily. Dirtily. I went to Wazoo, clearly.
I'll write that down.
It's a new word. I'll give me a pen. I'll add it to the dictionary. So, but it was just dumb. Ask somebody why they do something dumb. It's, you know, it's just, it was a stupid thing to do. And so in hindsight, you look back on it, it's so obvious. Just be honest and just say, yeah, I can't do it for free. This is a heck of a lot of work and got to take care of my family and all that. So fast forward, however many years, like 10, 12 years or so. And now there's a new allegation made in 2012. And this time it was not quick. This has been going on for 6 years. I've incurred well over $1 million in legal expenses so far. And we haven't even gotten to court yet. So they're doing discovery. They did depositions of like 35 people. They deposed my wife. They've deposed me like 5 times. And what I
okay,
think,
I want to stop you there.
Oh, go ahead.
You, I mean, I've been through a divorce. Are you nervous about your wife being deposed?
Oh, she already has been. It already has been. So the point I'm making is that what I've learned that's going on is litigation itself is the punishment. That the process is the punishment. That it doesn't matter if you're innocent or guilty of what they accuse you of, they can destroy you because they have the ability to be able to use taxpayer money to be able to do it. They've spent well over $1.5 million doing this investigation of me and full on dumpster dive. We're talking about 15 years of tax returns, mirrored my hard drive. They ended up getting all my emails, all my documents. They went through, poured through everything. And during that entire process, we've incurred legal expenses topping well past $1 million, and we don't have $1 million. So I've been asking people to give to a legal defense fund in order to be able to keep up with this stuff. But at the same time, I'm still trying to do initiatives at the same time. Doing initiatives are really hard. do an initiative when the government's trying to come down on you like a ton of bricks at the same time, it tends to be pretty overwhelming. So it kind of reached the breaking point where in November I filed for bankruptcy. The pressure and the awful intensity of the whole thing caused a break in our marriage. And it's just really awful stuff. But then like 30 days later, we actually managed to qualify this particular initiative for the ballot. And so the one thing that I was able to hang on to in the midst of this storm, this horrible hurricane, was there was this life preserver, which was, despite all this horrible, awful stuff, there's still going to be something on the ballot for the voters to have a chance to vote on. And to me, the ultimate goal of this lawsuit has nothing to do with whether or not I pay a fine. They're asking for $2.1 million, which is more money than I'll ever have. But the lawsuit says we want to impose a lifetime ban for the rest of his life from being able to do political activity in Washington State.
Is there a precedent for that?
Of course not. It's the most insane thing ever. And in court, I'm trying to argue what's called partial summary judgment. Let's knock that part out. That's so ridiculously unconstitutional. It's crazy. And the judge said, you know, I need to hear everything that's going to happen and make the whole case in order to be able to decide whether or not that's going to be necessary or not. But what I want to just make this point, it's the most honest part about the lawsuit. Not about the money. It's about a lifetime ban on all future political activity. I've been doing this stuff for 20 years. I'm 53 years old now. There's no reason I'm not going to be able to do it for another 20 or 30 years because I'm, you know, healthy and good gene pool or whatever. And I want to continue to do it. But the attorney general doesn't want me to be able to do it anymore. And if he can't get it from a court, if he can destroy me financially, he might be able to do it. So bankruptcy, I mean, it's a pretty intense thing. But I really want to throw this statistic out. The government has spent more money investigating me than all other government investigations on campaign finance reporting over the last 5 years combined.
Wow.
It's
so do you consider it a vendetta?
Thing.
Do you consider it a vendetta for Bob Ferguson?
I call him Fascist Fergie.
Yeah, so I know fascist, you do. I was trying to be more polite than
it's
that.
It's all good. It's pure fascism because it's an attempt to be able to squelch dissenting voices.
Okay.
And I hazard a guess that if I was doing liberal initiatives, I would not be being investigated. I'd be being subsidized. The reality is there's nobody that gets treated like this. And I think the reality is that'll come out, but it's been going on for 6 years. Who knows? It may go on for
but
another 6 years.
But you got an attorney now and a pretty good one.
Do.
So we're going to pick that up
when
we come back from this break. And we're going to talk about your attorney, but we're also going to then move on a little bit and talk about a couple of other things.
Yeah.
See, I'm going to let you squirm and think about that.
It's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good.
You're listening to Valley Talk on Valley 104.9 FM.
Remember to join us at 1 p.m. on Sunday for Animal Radio. Animal Radio is America's most listened to pet show. The nearly two-hour celebration of our pets is hosted by veterinary talent Hal Abrams and Judy Francis. So tune in, 1 p.m. Sunday, Animal Radio.
You're alone in the car. You don't know why. You're just not sure. There was something up there. Something out there. You heard it. You saw the eyes. The radio was on. It was Desert Oracle Radio on Valley 104.9 Community Radio. Sundays at 8 p.m.
Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Welcome back to Valley Talk. I'm Heather Stark here with Tim Eyman, our special guest. And I've learned a lot, Tim, and we'll probably get a lot of emails from the people who think that you and I are both just terribly conservative. But, you know, it's, I think, interesting to have these conversations. I do not like to not be able to talk about things regardless of how people view, politically. I think that we have to encourage conversation and we have to listen to each other. And one of my pet peeves is when people try to cut off conversation with adjectives or calling names. So that's my thing.
Yeah.
And
well,
I mean,
there's that famous Voltaire saying, you know, I may disagree with everything you say, but I'll fight to your death for your right to say it.
I don't think it's fight to your death. I think it's fight to my death.
Fight to my death yeah. for your right to say it. And the big point is not a lot of people feel that way anymore.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's I will fight to the death to make sure you can't mm-hmm. actually communicate your ideas because I disagree with them.
Yes.
And it's a really frightening time.
Well, and if I disagree with your ideas, it must be because you're stupid or mean-spirited. Those are clearly the only reasons that you and I would disagree.
And I have no problem with people having that as long as each side gets to express themselves. And mm-hmm. the part that is the beauty of the initiative process that I think I'm the most attracted to is that the voters get a chance to vote. Nobody knows how you vote, so you can vote any way you want to on it, and you don't have to be fearful of retaliation. You don't have to worry about your spouse, you know, being mad at you. You can't be, you know, your boss, or you can't have the government come after you for voting for the initiative. So what I find the
beauty well, wait
the
a minute,
process,
didn't you just describe somebody's coming after you from our government for your
not for my vote,
oh, okay.
For my activism, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that there are millions of people in the state of Washington that know that this is a completely dishonest vehicle tax, mm-hmm. but there are a whole lot of very powerful people that don't want people to vote for it. So there's a lot of pressure on people to vote mm-hmm. a certain way. But, you know, the beauty of the process is you can vote any way you want. You can yeah. tell your boss you voted against it, but you can vote your conscience and feel like, you know, you don't have to be fearful that something's going to happen bad mm-hmm. to you for supporting the initiative. And that's why I think I'm so attracted to the process, where it's so much pressure that the political process uses, where the pressure of the lobbyists, the pressure of the special interest groups, the pressure of the press, the news stories that are written, and politicians are trying to bend and twist and adjust themselves in order to be able to make everybody happy. And every once in a while, there's an idea that comes along that says, but you didn't solve this problem, high car tabs. Here's a chance for the voters to do it for them, and you don't have to worry about any kind of retaliation. I just think that's pretty cool.
Do you ever have any interest in running for political office?
None.
Why?
For 20 years, I've always been asked that question, and it's like it's such a narrow view of public service that the only way you can serve the public is by being an elected official. The thing that I like about the initiative process is I can propose an idea, but the idea doesn't become law unless a whole lot of people agree with it. A governor can make unilateral decisions, literally life and death decisions, about people's lives himself. Hmm. And I'm not comfortable making decisions on behalf of a bunch of people. The idea of unilaterally, Jay Inslee destroyed the vaping industry the other day. He himself said, I am now going to ban vaping. Whether you're for vaping or against vaping, no elected representatives voted on a bill. They didn't discuss it. They didn't have hearings on it. Jay Inslee decided to destroy an industry the other day. I can't feel comfortable doing that kind of thing. I also wouldn't want to be one more snake in the snake pit, where I'm part of this 147 mosh pit legislators, where they all seem kind of human and normal on the outside when they're outside Olympia, but they get into that mosh pit and they stop being human, mm-hmm. and they just make these collective decisions that just don't really make sense. And then they pull out
outside of that room,
and everything's passed, and you can't tell. Nobody's fingerprints seem to be on anything that mm-hmm. they did. And they never talk about the stuff they do because it's all this big morass. I call it the anonymity of chaos. They're doing so much stuff right in front of you that you don't know the totality of it all. And the initiative process is about, let me just pick one thing, taxes. Let me pick one tax, car tabs. Put that on the ballot and put a spotlight on that and say, this one, the voters, you ought to decide this one.
Okay. Most of the initiatives that you have come up with, not all of them, but most of them have to do with taxation. Is there any, what is the appropriate role of government and taxation? Is there any taxes that you think the government should be running around with?
Well,
or
I mean,
do you think that should be limited?
I mean, they do. I mean, it's 99.9% of all decisions and all the tax decisions. I mean, they raised taxes 11 different times this legislative session, and they raised taxes $27 billion over the next 10
years.
And
are you good with any of that, or do you think it all should be subject to review by the initiative process?
it's not realistic for the voters to be able to do every single one of them. You have to pick one, and you have to pick one that you think the voters are particularly upset about. We are doing an initiative that is seeking to let the voters vote on this combination of all these tax increases. We call it the Term Limits on Taxes initiative. But I guess the point I'm making is that they are always going to make 99.9% of the decisions. There's never a point where any one person is going to say, I don't like that system. Let's get rid of it. Let's change it. We have an initiative process that allows us to be able to nibble around the edges. But they're more accountable because at least we can nibble. At least they've got a 99.9% monopoly. I just don't want them to have 100%. And they freak out about the point one. They freak out about one initiative. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, it's like the voters are voting on one idea and you guys make all the others. But they're saying that, well, that's just one too many.
What's on the down the road for you? What's in the future? Immediately and perhaps long term?
I think, well, I mean, it is interesting on the lawsuit front. It's interesting. So the I declared bankruptcy. Once I went into bankruptcy, we ended up I hired an attorney. The attorney general's office opposed the attorney being named because they said he wasn't competent to be able to be my attorney. He was one of the most brilliant attorneys in the state. And the EG essentially bullied him off. So I had to represent myself for about 9 months. And I'm not a lawyer. And I proved it conclusively over the last 9 months. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was trying to survive and parry all these motions that they were doing and just deeper and deeper and deeper. And I couldn't get any lawyers to take the case because they saw what happened to my previous one. But I was very fortunate. And Richard Sanders, he's a former Supreme Court justice, had a law practice for 26 years, was 16 years on the Supreme Court, and he agreed to do it. But in bankruptcy, you have to get the attorney general's office to essentially agree. And it's a bizarre thing. You have to get your prosecutor to agree that you can have an attorney. And they couldn't, with a straight face, say that Richard Sanders is not competent to be able to represent me. And so he was named my attorney this week. So
okay. So you've got some legal representation.
I did. And I told Richard that I've set the bar very low, and I can guarantee you will be a very much better lawyer than I've been over the last 9 months, because I suck at this.
Okay. So that's the lawsuit. What about Tim Eyman's life? What comes next?
Well, it's one day at a time, always. You could always be hit by a bus, so you always have to take it one day at a time. And there's never been this big, massive, long-term plan. I mean, you know, let me just say this real fast. I mean, I was born and raised Yakima. I went to Wazoo, got a business degree. I was always very entrepreneurial growing up, and I always thought my life was going to be, you know, start some company and run it. And for whatever reason, in my mid-30s, you know, this political stuff kind of took over my life. And it's honestly the greatest joy in my life. It's incredibly gratifying. There's just a lot of really nice people that have helped me over the last 20 years be able to survive all this stuff that happens to you. And I feel I owe it to them to continue to do it. But it's just every day is an absolute piece of joy for me. And there's no bad days. And I remembered hearing this a long time ago. And it's like, find what you love to do and you'll never work a day in your life. And for the last 20 years, I haven't worked a single day, because every day I am just absolute euphoria because I'm doing what I think, you know, I think I'm doing what I was born to do. And I love every aspect of it. And so I've done it for 20 years. And I have no doubt that I'll continue to try and do it for the next 20. But it is kind of frightening that the stated goal of this lawsuit is to prohibit me from being politically active for the rest of my life. I mean, I'm born and raised Washington. I mean, I could, you know, everyone keeps saying, well, why don't you just move out of state and stuff? And I'm like, I can't, with my tail between my legs, just run away and let the government get away from squelching somebody that they just disagree with politically. It would just send a horrible message that the government can do that to somebody.
Yeah. I must say that I was kind of shocked when I saw that was the, and the other thing that kind of shocked me was his avowal to not reach a settlement.
That he said, when he announced the lawsuit in March 2017, he said, if Mr. Eyman wants to settle this case, he's coming to the wrong place. We're going all the way. And I remembered my attorney, you know, breaking attorney-client privilege. He goes, they settled with a Green River Killer. They settled with
well, maybe
Green
you just have
River
to tell them where the
killer.
Bodies are buried, Tim.
That's what I'm saying. It's like we the state are willing to settle a guy who murdered tens of people, you know, prostitutes and all.
Well, excuse me, he didn't mess with their money, okay?
That's what I'm saying. But Tim Iman, we have a campaign reporting dispute going on, you know? No way are we ever going to settle that one. I mean, it is so disproportionate, so over the top, and I do like this metaphor, and I hope people understand it. There's a movie called Cool Hand Luke, and Paul Newman is the main character in it, and there's one scene in there where he's in a fight with this bigger guy, and he's getting knocked down, and he keeps getting back up, and the crowd on the yard is cheering. And as time goes on, he keeps getting beat up, and he keeps getting back up, and they say, "Stay down, Luke, just stay down. He's bigger than you. It's nothing wrong with that." And he said, "You're going to have to kill me." And at that point, the crowd stops cheering because they say it's not a fair fight anymore. And I really think that that's what's been happening over the last 6 years, is that I'm getting punched and punched and punched and punched. And there was cheering at first, but now I think people are starting to go, "This just doesn't seem, you know, right. I mean, he's one person and you're using more resources on him than all other cases over the last 5 years combined. And what's this about again? Campaign reporting? I mean, wow, this is..." So anyway, I'm going to keep fighting as long as I can fight. There's really nice people that are helping me. And as long as I can, you know, raise enough money to pay the lawyers, I'm going to keep fighting back.
Okay. Well, Tim, I have enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah.
And I never thought I would hear you compare yourself to Voltaire and Paul Newman in the same conversation, but you did. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, the only character I can think of in a movie that I could compare myself to. Tell me why my mind is going, "Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?" Good one.
I do think I got one more movie metaphor. There's a scene in Gladiator where Russell Crowe says, "I will have my revenge in this life or the next."
Okay, all right.
In the
there
next.
You go.
I think it may be in the all next right. where there might be some
Well, that's
justice.
Only because he had a Mustang hidden behind that one movie set. Remember
right.
seeing that Easter egg?
I do.
Tim, I have enjoyed our conversation. Thank you very much for coming out here to the Sticks and talking with us on Valley 104.9 FM. And we're going to be airing this on Sunday and Tuesday in the coming weeks. And thank you.
Hey,
I've enjoyed our conversation.
No, it was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening on Valley 104.9 FM.